Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of ITE 1 Class 1 Chapter 6, Laptops. Aren't they wonderful things? I don't think there's anyone in this class who doesn't have a laptop. Is there anyone who doesn't? Well, that just shows how popular they are. One of the first laptops was the GRID Compass 1101, and it was used by astronauts on space missions in the early 80s. It weighed 11 pounds, or 5 kgs, and cost $8,000, which, I can't imagine carrying that around, especially with our little netbooks and things that we have today. Welcome, whoever that was. Of course, laptops, PDAs, and smartphones are becoming increasingly popular. And in this lecture today, we're going to describe laptops and other portable devices. We'll identify and describe components of a laptop, compare and contrast desktop and laptop components, explain how to configure laptops, compare the different mobile phone standards, and identify the common preventive maintenance techniques for laptops and portable devices, and there's a troubleshooting right at the end. There is a diagram in this introductory section about the evolution of laptops, which you can look at for your own interest, but it really isn't essential knowledge, so we won't cover it here. Let's get straight on here, and before we go any further, I'll say that notebooks, laptops and tablets are types of portable computers. For clarity and consistency in this course, all portable computers are called laptops. Okay, before we go any further, I've got a friend with me, as I said to some of you before. Elizabeth Ellis is my caseworker at Emerge Supported Employment, which I've been a member of for a number of years, and she's just sitting here observing to see how we do things here at CAVI. Okay, so laptops are getting cheaper, lighter, more capable, and more configurable all the time. PDAs and smartphones are also doing that, and they're also merging in terms of their capacity and capability. Those things offer games, web surfing, email, instant messaging, and many other features that are offered by PCs. The main difference between a PC, a PDA and a smartphone is that a smartphone has mobile phone capabilities, and I think a good example of the difference between those two is the iPad and the iPhone. The iPad you could call a PDA because it has all of the capabilities which we'll discuss a little bit more of in a little while, and the iPhone has the iPad's capabilities but also a mobile phone as well. So I think those are a great example of the PDA and the cell phone. Okay, what are some of the things we can use a laptop for, people?
Playing games when you're on holiday.
Absolutely, everything.
Yeah, absolutely everything. You're right. Presenting information in business meetings, accessing data away from home or the office, playing games, of course, got to have those, watching movies, accessing the internet in a public place or in a standalone, doing your email, and VoIP, of course, which Elise did to a great extent when she was away in Arizona last year, talking with me and other people. It was good to hear what was going on around the place and that she was talking with Jackie sitting on her dining room floor or at the dining room table or in a hotel room from the Grand Canyon, which is quite cool. Yeah, so smartphones and PDAs can be used for the same thing. They've been around since the 1970s. A PDA might have a keyboard, a tiny keyboard, a touch screen, and the cut-down version of the operating system. And as I said,
A braille display if you've got enough money.
Oh, yes, of course, and a braille display. But this is a sightling course, Kate. You know, they forget about braille displays. They don't know about those things. But, yes, you are right. They do have a braille display if you've got enough money. The cell phone, of course, the smartphone combines the capabilities of the smartphone and the cell phone in one handheld device, which is very convenient. And they may have additional things like a built-in camera, document access, email, abbreviated note-taking, TV, someone mic'd up? Okay, no. They also have Bluetooth and regular USB cable connections and Wi-Fi, and we'll talk more about those sorts of things later. Okay, laptop features. What are some common features of laptops that don't exist in desktop? What are some common things you can say about laptops?
They've got an integrated screen in the left.
Yes, Kate. John, you were saying?
Small and portable.
Oh, sure are. They're getting smaller and more portable all the time, actually. So, yeah, that's kind of neat, really. I wonder how far they'll be able to go. Anything else?
Integrated keyboard.
They do, and there's another. It's a really important one. What is it?
They can operate from a rechargeable battery as well as AC.
Yep, that's right, they can. And we'll talk a lot more about power management of the batteries and later on, because that's really important. You've got quite a lot of flexibility in Windows, and that you can manage how the power in a laptop is used when you're not plugged into the wall. They also support hot swappable drives and peripherals. So, let's take a quick around a laptop and a docking station, because docking stations are an important part of laptop life, especially if you've got a large laptop. I've got one and it's fairly permanent and you want to keep it somewhere permanently. Docking stations have made a lot of advances. You can get universal ones now, but we'll talk a bit more about those later. Okay, the components outside a laptop. Now, that refers to the components on a laptop that are accessed from the outside with the lid closed, as opposed to inside the laptop, which actually are not the motherboard and the CPU and all those things. We'll talk about those later. When we talk about inside the laptop in this chapter, we talk about the things that are inside the laptop when the lid's open. Okay, just so that's as clear as mud, or not. Anyway, that's their terminology and that's what they're using. Okay, the peripherals on a laptop are interchangeable, but the ports and connectors are much the same as on a desktop, but with a few extras. Laptops also have PC card or express card slots to add functionality, such as memory, a modem, or a network connection. You'll also find status indicators, ports, slots, connectors, bays, jacks, vents, and a keyhole area on the exterior of the laptop. Okay, let's talk about LEDs first, because on a laptop, they're quite important. And the first one you need to be aware of is the Bluetooth. Who has a Bluetooth capability on their laptop?
Yep.
Okay. The Bluetooth status LED indicates the Bluetooth wireless transceiver is enabled. Bluetooth is a wireless industry standard that enables portable devices to communicate over short distances. So it's a short-range device. Now, would you like to explain to the class what the symbol looks like? And the reason I've asked Elise to do that is because it's in your module exam. And if we don't do it, you may not get the answer. So if you could just explain what the Bluetooth symbol looks like, that'd be cool. Okay, well, perhaps later. But it is important, so we'll come back to that. The battery. There's a battery status LED that indicates the condition of the computer battery. The type of battery and how the laptop is used affects how long a battery charge will last. Okay. Now, how would you determine the condition of the battery with your screen reader?
In the system tray, under power.
Exactly, that's the quickest way to do it. So, look in your system tray and you will see the battery counter in there. It'll tell you what percentage you've got. And if you've set alarms in your power scheme or power plan, they'll be set up there as well. Okay, the next LED we need to talk about is the standby one, and that indicates the reduced power mode of the laptop. Standby, and we'll talk more about what standby and the power states are much later. We're not going to spend time on them now because I want to spend the time later when we have a good talk about ACPI. LEDs may vary by manufacturer, so just be aware of that. On a laptop, you might also find a parallel port. And who can tell me what a parallel port is and what it's for?
It's a 15-pin connector for printers and scanners.
15-pin? I'll check that out. Yeah, but definitely for printers and scanners. It's not used much anymore. I've actually got a parallel port on my old machine here. But I don't think... I may not have one on the laptop, or there is on the port replicator that I sometimes use too, so... you may find a parallel port on the laptop. Anyone remember what the industry standard for a parallel port is? It's 1284. And that's something we're going to discuss more in the next chapter on printers, because there probably will be questions in that exam regarding the parallel port standard. Okay, On the laptop, you'll also find an AC power connector, which is pretty self-explanatory, even though they have an explanation here. It is used to plug it into a wall and to charge the battery. You'll also find a battery bay, and that's a connector that is used to attach a laptop battery. It's actually an external bay. And laptop batteries are manufactured in various shapes and sizes. They use different types of chemicals and metals to store power. We'll finish looking at the laptop first before we'll explain about different types of batteries. On a laptop you'll also find something called a security keyhole, and that's for plugging in a security cable to attach it to something when you want to make sure that light fingers don't get hold of it. The USB, you'll also find several USB ports on a laptop. And that's a socket, of course, that is used to connect one or more peripherals. Like what, people? What can we connect via USB these days? Hit me.
Just about everything. Printer?
Yep. What else? Come on.
Did you get my two mice keyboards?
Mice, yes, Terry, I didn't. Yep.
Memory, things like flash drives and storage devices?
Yep. Pretty much everything. Okay. Another connector you might find is an S-video connector. And that's to connect, it's a 4-pin DIN connector, by the way, and that's used to output video signals, to a compatible device. An S-video separates the brightness and colour portions of a video signal. You've also got your modem RJ11, which we all know connects you up to the telephone line, and hardly anyone ever uses these days. You can connect it to a fax machine and an answer machine as well. There's the Ethernet RJ45, and that is the old RJ11 on steroids, and that connects you to the cabled local area network. And then you'll find your network LED, and they are used to indicate the status of the network connection. There's usually a green link light that indicates the network connectivity, and there's another light to indicate the traffic to and from the laptop. And of course they vary by manufacturer as well. And then you've got your standard stereo, headphone and microphone jack. On a laptop you've also got various ventilation ports, because laptops combine a lot of electronic components in a small space, much smaller than a desktop, so they get really hot. So ventilation is very important on the laptop, and it's also important not to obstruct those. Okay, there's also the PC combo expansion slot. And that is an expansion slot that supports the Express Card expansion cards in the laptop slot and PC cards in the bottom slot. We'll talk more about Express Cards later, partly because it's an important difference between the two, desktop and laptop, and partly because you usually get questioned in your exam about these things. There's an infrared port. Who remembers infrared? I hated using the thing.
I could never ever get it to work right.
I had a Canon bubble jet. Printer, a portable one, I used to hook up to my Braille note using infrared, but I had to have them centimetres away from each other for the thing to work. Now, the thing you need to know about an infrared communication, it is line of sight, and that's a test alert. It is line of sight wireless transceiver that is used for data transmission. And laptops also have speakers, and they vary in quality just like the laptops. The last thing a laptop has is a latch. And that is a lever that's used to open the laptop lid. You might also find an optical drive in laptops, and we'll talk more about optical drives later when we get to preventative maintenance. It's got an activity indicator that's an LED that illuminates when the drive's in use. And it's got a drive bay status indicator, and that is an LED that illuminates when the drive is installed in the laptop bay correctly. On a laptop, you might also find a VGA port. Anyone know what a VGA port is?
That wouldn't be to plug a screen in, would it?
It would, yeah. Good old chapter one. See, they're always reinforcing the material here. I'm skating over this a bit because laptops vary so much that I'm not going into too much detail about what's on a laptop, because you're all capable of looking at your own laptops and seeing what's there, and also of reading your notes. There's also a docking station connector, and that's a socket used to attach a laptop to a docking station. Of course, universal ones attach by other means, so that makes it much easier. There's a couple of battery latches, and they are the levers that are used when inserting, removing, or securing the laptop battery. This is where on the bottom of the laptop now, by the way, the battery latches. Also on the bottom you'll find the RAM access panel, and that is of course the cover that provides access to the expansion memory, and there's a hard drive access panel also, and that one has a screw in it. Now that we've had a bit of a look around a laptop, has anyone got any questions before we go on to talk about the four types of batteries? Yeah, all pretty self-explanatory, isn't it, really? You know, there's nothing horrendously difficult about this. Okay, let's run through the battery comparison just quickly. Nickel-cadmium.
Bye.
Nickel-cadmium. Who remembers the good old NiCad battery? I hated the things.
You don't want them, you don't want to half discharge them and then charge them up again a lot because they'll build up a memory.
They sure do, and the thing I really hated about them is you get no warning when they were out. You would be playing your music or doing whatever, and suddenly it will stop. They didn't gradually. You didn't have any warning, which is what I really hated most about them. Apart from the memory, it says may exhibit memory effect here. Oh yeah, they sure do. They're used in toys, cordless phones, emergency lighting, power tools, and camera flash. And for disposal, it says to check your local rules. Actually, do that for all batteries. Do not incinerate or put in a landfill. Cadmium is toxic. Good old, yeah. The next one is nickel metal hydride, which I found slightly better. It says here that they're moderate weight for their power. They may experience polarity reversal at the end of a cycle. If that happens, shut down or recharge at once. And you may need several recharge-discharge cycles to reach the full capacity. They are a hassle, but I think they have slightly less memory effect than the NiCads do. You find those in cell phones, digital cameras, GPD units, whatever they are, flashlights and other consumer electronics. And, of course, with disposal, they're less toxic than the NiCad, but also be very careful with them. Now, lithium-ion is something that you see much more commonly these days than the other two, although you will see the other two around in some devices. And they're lightweight for their power. They have no memory effect, but they can easily overheat, and you'll notice in some laptops. I think there was something about laptop batteries overheating in a brand recently. Can anyone remember a news story about that? It was only in the last couple of years.
I think it was Dell.
Sony.
Yeah, it was one of those, but yeah, they had a problem with overheating laptop batteries, so just be aware of that. You can charge them often, but you need to look for the freshest batteries. That's the most recently manufactured ones. And of course, now you'll find them in cell phones and laptops. Again, disposal, the contents are flammable, so don't be messing around too much with those. Check your local rules. The last one on the list is lithium polymer, they're expensive. They're small and lightweight for their power, and they have moderate capacity and a fast recharge. They have a moderate lifespan. Don't short circuit them, or obviously not. They're not flammable. They're, I think, becoming more common now. They're your latest iteration of battery. So you'll find them in PDAs, laptop computers, portable MP3 players, portable gaming devices, and radio-controlled airplanes. And disposal, again, for all batteries is check local rules. Okay, before we open the lid of the
laptop... Maybe Qantas should get some of those for their aeroplanes instead of the engines that they've got.
Oh, yeah. I wonder how many they might need, do you think?
Probably one or two.
Yeah. Okay, has anyone got any questions or comments before we open the lid and check out what's inside a laptop? Okay, let's open up. As with desktops, laptops can use input devices to add functionality. And installing these might require downloading drivers from the manufacturer's website, although most of it's plug and play these days. Yes. And there are lots of input devices. Can anyone tell me some input devices that apply to laptops and portables?
I'm using a Bluetooth keyboard.
Yep. What else?
Do you your optical drives and memory drives?
No, they're peripherals. We're talking about input devices now. Things that input data and or information into the laptop, it's like a stylus, for instance. That does it. On a tablet, you have a stylus.
Okay.
Is a scanner.
A mouse.
Yep. Webcam. What else?
Microphone.
My computer's actually got a TV antenna input thing too.
Okay, so we all know about input devices for laptops, and you control, you configure these through the control panel or under programs in the start menu usually. All right, you've got more LEDs under the lid. Wireless, Bluetooth, and hard drive indicators. Now, wireless, of course, is for your Wi-Fi connection, and we'll learn more about Wi-Fi connections in Chapter 8. But that indicates the status of the Wi-Fi connection, whether it's on or off, and you may have other indicators on your network telling you what that's doing, but that varies by manufacturer. Bluetooth, and I'll ask E to tell us about the Bluetooth indicator and the Bluetooth symbol, because it's something you need to know about. E? Elise, you there?
Sorry. Yep, what's up?
Bluetooth symbol.
Oh, I can't really describe it. I'm going to have to bring it up. It's a funny looking egg-shaped symbol that actually has these different funny little shapes in it, like diamonds and squares and stuff.
Yeah, it's, I think there's triangles with some lines through it or something like that, isn't there?
Something like that. It's a real odd looking thing.
Yeah, it is a test alert, so be aware that it's a short range form of communication. That is the clue that they'll give you in the description. Now, also inside the lid, the LEDs, you'll find a numlock indicator and a caps lock indicator. And then, of course, they both tell you if their various devices are on or off. And there's battery, power on, off, and hibernate standby. And that indicates whether the computer is in standby mode or if it's entering or leaving hibernate mode. Okay, and indicators can vary by laptop. Also in the lid, we've got a laptop monitor, which is your built-in screen, which is usually what sort of screen, people?
LCD.
Yep, it is. It's usually an LCD screen, and it often has buttons to control brightness, contrast, and resolution. It's integrated into the lid, and it's usually an LCD. If you want a desktop monitor on your laptop, you'll need to plug it into the video port, press the appropriate key and FN key. Now, the FN key is one key on the keyboard you'll find on a laptop that you won't find on a desktop. And what that does is it gives the function keys dual purposes, like adjusting the display, volume, sleep states, wireless, and battery level. And on many laptops, a small, the last thing we'll look at is on many laptops, there's a small laptop cover On many laptops, a small pin on the laptop cover contacts a switch when the case is closed, and that's called an LCD cutoff switch. The LCD cutoff switch tells the CPU to conserve power by extinguishing the backlight and turning off the LCD. If the switch breaks or is dirty, the LCD remains dark while the laptop is open. So if you open your laptop one day and turn the thing on and it's dark, it may not be that your screen has died. It may be that just got a dirty LCD cutoff switch. And you carefully clean
That's
this.
That's a good cheap way to save battery power then, is dirty your contact switch so that the LCD is off.
There are easier ways of doing that, I think, especially if you ever want it to have, need it on, if you need a sightling's help with anything. Yeah. But you can carefully clean the switch to restore normal operation. Okay, we've now had a look around the laptop. Before I go on to base stations, has anyone got any questions or comments?
I have one on the difference between the blue ray and the infrared. Are they different? As far as you said, the blue ray was close or
Bluetooth.
Bluetooth was very close, and the infrared was direct line of sight, but they're both for communication, right?
Yeah, they are. Bluetooth is much more sophisticated than infrared. You use Bluetooth to pair up the two devices, and it has a much longer range, although it's still short range of communication than infrared does. The key difference is that infrared is line of sight. It's a very rudimentary form of communication between two devices compared with Bluetooth and others. So that's your key difference. And a Bluetooth infrared sort of got this a little sort of square plastic Perspex covered connector usually, and it's got to be line of sight. In my view, they're pretty unreliable, but you may still see them around. Bluetooth's the one you need to know a bit more about, mainly because it's more relevant in my view. But we'll talk more about what the different connections are later. No problem. Okay. Well, if you're like me and you want to have your laptop permanently housed somewhere and you want to add functionality, a good way is to buy yourself a base station, either a port replicator or a docking station. And they let you attach extra peripherals and add functionality. Now, the port replicators are smaller than a docking station, and they have fewer features. A docking station has speakers and audio input and PC slots. Both port replicators and docking stations, but more docking stations, can be manufacturer specific and model specific. So if you want to buy a port replicator in particular, you need to buy it for the correct model as well as the manufacturer. But docking stations can be universal, and they're usually plugged in by USB. And that means that it doesn't matter what kind of laptop you've got, or if you've got many different laptops, you can hook them up to that docking station if you like, and it's a relatively easier thing to do. Of course, you don't have the problem that I think a friend of Kim's had with trying to get the thing to fit properly, which is always a difficulty when you're using proprietary gear like that. Okay, on a docking station you will find a power button which controls the power to the laptop as well as the base station. There's an eject button, and that's to release the laptop from the docking station when you want to take it away. There's the docking connector, of course, which connects to the docking connector on the laptop. There's an exhaust vent because you need to provide some way of expelling all that lovely hot air from the energy you're using. There's an AC power connector, of course, PC card or express card slot, and that's an expansion slot that supports the express card expansion cards in the top slot and PC cards in the bottom. Usually, it's not always the case. You usually find a VGA port and a DVI port, which is a 24-pin, which is for digital rather than analog video output, which is what VGA is for. You will find a line-in connector usually, and a headphone connector, and USB ports, sometimes also PS2 ports, and sometimes an external diskette drive connector, although I haven't seen one of those for a very, very long time. You might also find a parallel port, a serial port, modem port, Ethernet. There's also a key lock on the right side of this particular docking station, but it varies by manufacturer. And the key lock is a socket into which a key is inserted to lock the laptop to the docking station. So that's a quick look around the docking stations. Really all that you need to know with this section is that the difference between the two. A port replicator is a bit smaller, and a docking station has extra functionality, speakers, sometimes even another sound card, and extra inputs and outputs. Okay, before we can go to compare the differences between laptop and desktop components, is there any questions? Okay, well, as you already know, or as you already will be aware, most of the functions that a desktop performs can also be performed by a laptop, but parts are not interchangeable. I'm going to say that again. Parts are not interchangeable, unlike in a desktop. And they're not interchangeable either between a desktop and a laptop, or between a laptop brands. So, for instance, you couldn't ever exchange the parts of a helicopter with the parts of an aeroplane. It just wouldn't work. So in the same way, you can't exchange parts with a desktop and a laptop, or between laptop brands. And this term, this state, is known as proprietary. Okay, let's look at motherboards. What can you tell me about desktop motherboards. What's important about desktop motherboards, people?
They're rectangular, and you can put different manufacturers' motherboards. You don't have to have like a Dell motherboard in a Dell laptop case.
Exactly, and the rectangular shape of...
Did you ask that question again?
What do you know about desktop motherboards? Terry has said some things there. She was talking about the rectangular shape. So what are we talking about here when we talk about size and shape?
Okay, no, I got it. I heard what I wanted to, not what you said. Thank you.
Okay, so what's size and shape, people, in terms of components? What are we talking here?
Form factor.
Yes, Terry, exactly. Okay. Unlike the desktop motherboards, laptop motherboards are proprietary and they're shaped to fit the laptop case. So always use the motherboard that's recommended by the manufacturer. Some motherboard components are also different. In a laptop, you've got mini PCI. In the desktop, you've got PCI and PCIe, ISA and AGP. What's AGP, folks? Anyone remember?
Accelerated graphics.
And that takes a what sort of card?
Video.
Yay, excellent. Okay. RAM is also different. In a laptop, you have small outline dual inline memory module, or SODIMM, S-O-D-I-M-M. And of course, in the desktop, what are the two main desktop modules you will see in RAM?
DDR.
No, that's the memory type. There are two modules. Three, actually, but two that you, or only really two that you'll see.
There's the DIMM.
Yeah, dual inline memory module, and the, come on, someone else.
RIM. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a RIM. You don't really see RIM, but there's also the single inline memory module, which is the older one. So laptops have SODIMM, small outline DIMMs, and desktop have DIMM or SIM. Maybe RIM if you're really lucky. Okay, processors. So just going over the motherboard, in a desktop, of course, motherboards rely on form factor. And in the laptops, they are shaped to fit the laptop case, and the slots on the laptop motherboards are different. Now, in the processors, of course, the CPU is the brain of the computer, and it interprets and processes instructions that are used to manipulate data. The laptop processors use less power and create less heat than desktop processors, and they do it by throttling, and that's reducing speed. So that reduces power and heat and extends the life of the components so that they can cope with the reduced power provided by a battery. And you need to see your manufacturer for replacement advice of a processor. There is a chart in section 3.3.2 which details processors, laptop processors at different speeds and wattages for your interest. So it might be worth reading through those. So basically the processor is pretty much the same processor, but it uses less speed. It uses throttling, which actually is the use of less speed to conserve power and heat. Because of course you've got a small space inside there. You haven't got room for a lot of heat to build up before disaster happens. Okay. The desktop and laptop power management. Now, here we get into the nitty-gritty a little bit, although we'll do the section on ACPI a little bit later. Power management controls the flow of electricity to components of a computer. Desktops usually get a nice regular flow of AC power because they're always plugged into the wall, but laptops can only use DC power. AC power is converted to DC power when the laptop is plugged in. The battery is also charged at that time, of course. Of course, desktops also have a small battery called a watt, people. What's the desktop battery called?
CMOS.
Hey, someone's awake. Goodness. Okay. Yep, it's the MOS battery. There are two methods of power management. There's the Advanced Power Management, APM, and Advanced Configuration and Power Interface, ACPI or ACP. APM is an earlier version of power management, and with APM, the BIOS was used to control the settings for power management. With ACP, which has replaced APM, it offers additional power management features from APM, and it also uses the operating system to control the power management. So, with APM, power management was controlled by BIOS, and with ACP, it's controlled by the operating system. Okay, and we will talk more about power management in a separate section a bit later. Any questions so far?
I just want to clear one thing up. I said on that 15 pin, I just found where I got that in my head, Kylie. It's for the VGA is a 15 pin connector, not the parallel.
Yes, I thought so. VGA is 15 and DVI is 24. Parallel is 36. I think I'll have to look that up. Anyway, you don't see them as much these days, good old parallel. They're being replaced by USB and FireWire mainly. And speaking of that, we talk about expansion capabilities because, of course, laptops can use those things to expand just as well as a desktop can. It's form factor that makes the difference in the expansion. To accommodate limited space, the same size bays can hold different components, which can be hot swapped when needed. Can anyone tell me what hot swappable is?
Means that you can plug something in and unplug something without turning the machine on or off?
Yep, the machine should be actually on when you do that. Without you can plug or unplug it without having to turn it off.
Like a keyboard.
No, not really like a keyboard, but we'll go into that story a bit later when we talk about preventive maintenance and cleaning.
Yes. I'm on the side, yes. Not a politically correct story.
No, it's not, but it was fun. And Terry was a witness to this, weren't you, Terry?
Sorry, what's that?
Hot swapping the keyboard when it wasn't supposed to be hot swapped.
Absolutely.
Okay. And because we're talking about expansion, we need to talk about PC cards because you don't find them quite so much in a desktop unless you've got a USB reader. PC cards follow the PC MCIA standard, and you'll see that term around a lot when you're talking about these things. They come in three types, type 1, type 2, and type 3, and that's Roman numerals, folks. Each type of PC card is different in size and can attach to different devices. And there's a newer type of PC card called the PC Express card. This is all stuff that you'll be asked for in exams. And there's a comparison in Figure 2 that shows the PC cards and PC Express cards. The PC Express card comes in 34mm and 54mm widths. That's millimetre, for those of you who aren't as familiar with millimetres and centimetres. Figure 3 has an example of the PC card and PC Express cards. Right, let's just run through the different characteristics of the cards, because it's important to know this. Type 1 is 85.6mm by 54mm. That's its length and width. The thickness is 3.3mm. And it's a memory I.O. interface, card bus. And examples of use are an SRAM and flash. What's SRAM, people?
Simple RAM?
No, it's used for a specific purpose too in a computer. Chapter 1, something to do with memory. Static RAM, and it's used for, now that I've jogged your memories, forgotten so soon. Oh dear. It's used for cache, or cache, depending on which part of the world you come from. Oh, just seeing if you're awake. Okay. Type 2 is the same size as Type 1. That is 85.6 by 54 mil, but it's 5 mil thick instead of 3.3. It's the same interface, and it can be used by modem, LAN, or wireless networks. The Type 3 is the same size again as Type 1 and 2, but it's 10.5 mil thick instead of 3.3 or 5 mil. It uses the same interface, and it's commonly used, or has been used in the past, for hard drives. I have a PCMCIA slot in my Braille note and in my large laptop, which takes Type 3, I believe, rather than the Express cards. Now, the Express card, and this will be an exam question, they always ask you this, Express card 34. Now, Express cards are defined by the width of the card, not by the thickness. The old Type 1, 2, and 3 are defined by the thickness. Express cards are defined by width, and there are two, 34mm wide and 54mm wide. And you can use the 34 in FireWire, TV, tuner, wireless, or a network card. An Express 54, which of course is 54mm wide, can be used for smart card reader, compact flash reader. Now, there's one other difference between the 34 and 54mm card that you need to note. The 54mm has a little bit cut out of the corner. So when you see something with a description that it's this wide and this long and it's used for laptop communication, has a little bit of thing, it has a corner cut out, then you'll know it's a 54mm Express card. You can also use them as a 1.8-inch disk drive, apparently, though I haven't actually ever seen that. Any questions about the PC cards before we move on to section 6.4? Sorry. Well, I've either confused you all horribly, or you've fallen asleep.
I don't have any questions. I've never physically touched one of those cards. I probably would have more questions if I fiddled with them more.
Yeah, as I said, some of us used to use the old type cards, the old PC cards in our machines. Kate, you will remember those from your Braille note. Does the Apex have one of those, or is it given up?
No, fortunately they have given up. And I was just sitting here trying to work out what type the Braille note would have used.
Type 2, usually, in my experience. We're always looking for Type 2 flash cards, and so I had to have a PCMCIA adapter. You could put Type 1 in them. I actually hadn't ever seen Type 3, although I think they are around. I think iOmega used to make them.
Yeah, no, I've only ever seen the adapter one that we use for the Braille note, and yes, I think you're right, it's a Type 2. That's the only sort I've ever seen.
Yeah, newer laptops are meant to have Express card slots in them. Kim or Elise, have you got Express card slots in your laptops?
Kim said she used to. Being asked to tell you that. I don't know why.
Hey,
hotkeys. She's got gating problems with her hotkeys. Sorry. We got big problems here, gang, so we're really not paying a great deal of attention. Sorry about this. There's been a problem in the business I'll have to tell you about later, Kylie. Sorry.
Hey, Kylie, I've got a question here.
Yes, Terry.
I've got a compact flash card slot in my PC, but that wouldn't necessarily be an Express card slot, would it?
No, it's likely to be Type 2 or, probably Type 1 or 2, I should think.
I have a question, Kylie.
Yes, John.
On a laptop, can you run the Bell Arc on a laptop just like you can on a desktop and get all that information?
Of course you can. Oh, yeah, it's just a piece of software. You can run it on anything you like, and it will give you the same information. So have a try and see.
Yeah, I ran it yesterday on mine trying to find out the brand and model of my keyboard, but it didn't come up with it.
Comes up with everything else, even your motherboard. It's very handy.
Yeah, it's about the only thing it won't tell you, actually. It tells you everything else, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I wanted to buy this keyboard that I'm using is my daughter's, and I wanted to buy one exactly the same. And so, not having anyone here who can read, I thought, oh, I'll use Bell Arc to find out, but nah.
I won't tell you about the peripherals.
If you look in the manual on your Apex, was it on your Apex you're looking for the keyboard? if you look in the manual anyway of either one, you will find that the manufacturer has recommendations on what keyboard you should have.
Another good place to, if you want it for your Apex, is the Humanware website, because they sometimes list things like that there if they're not in the manual.
Oh, no, this one works perfectly well on the Apex. I just plugged it in and it worked, but I just want to get one for myself.
Is an Apex a laptop that's designed and put out for the blind, or is it just a laptop that blind people are using?
Actually, it's listed more, it's considered as a PDA rather than a laptop.
It's made by Humanware. Okay, let's talk about laptop configurations, and I'll need you to be around if you can, E, for this, because this is where you wanted to talk about ACPI. So we will do that in a while. Okay, with laptops, you need to be a bit more flexible with configuration, because changing components and allocating system resources may be necessary according to your requirements and or your environment. Configuration is mainly achieved via plug and play, as I mentioned earlier, though you may still need to install some drivers. And of course, the best place to get those is the manufacturer's website, because they've always got the latest ones. Of course, you need to take extra care messing around inside a laptop because of the space restrictions, and also when removing hot swappable components. One of the more configurable aspects on a laptop is its power settings. Okay, 6.4.1 for anyone who's following the notes. Who doesn't love the fact that we can get out and about with our laptops? And this, of course, is due to battery power, and nowadays advances in battery management mean that we're able to do this for increasing lengths of time before we need to get to a wall socket. When we talk power management, we're talking Advanced Configuration and Power Interface, ACPI. And the notes have to say this about ACPI. The ACPI standards create a bridge between the hardware and OS, its operating system, and allow technicians to create power management schemes to get the best performance from the computer. The ACPI standards can be applicable to most computers, but they are particularly important when managing power in laptops. Let's look at Figure 1 in 6.4.1 relating to system states. And this is important. It's things that you tend to get tested on. These states have different names according to different manufacturers and different circles. But as a generic rule of thumb, you have S0, standard 0, the computer is on and the CPU is running. S1, the CPU and RAM are still receiving power, but unused devices are powered down. And you've also seen that state if you're running a laptop, I'm sure, when you've been trying to conserve a battery. S2, the CPU is off, but the RAM is refreshed. The system is in a low power mode than S1. In S3, the CPU is off, but the RAM is set to a slow refresh rate. This mode is often called save to RAM, and in Windows XP, the state is known as suspend mode or standby mode, and in Windows Vista and 7, it's known as sleep mode. So, it's S3 is saved to RAM, which means any documentation you have there is saved temporarily, of course, in RAM, and so you can power up the laptop quickly. S4, the CPU and RAM are off, and the contents of the RAM have been saved to a temporary file on the hard disk. This mode is also called saved to disk, of course. In Windows XP, it's called as hibernate mode, and also in Windows Vista and 7. But Vista and 7 have a hybrid, which is between sleep and hibernate, which we'll talk about a little bit later. The S5 state is when the computer is off and nothing has been saved. So there are 6 states from 0 to 5. 0 being that everything's up and running, and 5 being everything is turned off. Now, you must enable ACPI mode in BIOS to allow the OS to configure all the power management states. You frequently need to configure the power settings by changing the settings found in the BIOS. And in the BIOS, you can mess around with the following conditions. It affects system states, battery and AC modes, thermal management, CPU, PCI bus power management, wake on LAN, which you might need a cable connection from the network adapter to the motherboard. Now, here are the steps to check the ACPI settings in BIOS. Enter the BIOS setup by pressing the appropriate key or combination on the computer when booting. It's usually the delete key. Actually, on my netbook, it's F10, which is a toggle. I've never seen that before, but on my little HP, F10 is usually the save settings and exit BIOS, but on mine it's used to enter BIOS as well, so it could be a number of things, and so you'll need to check your manufacturer's details so that you know which it is. Okay, once you've entered BIOS, you locate and enter the power management settings menu item. Use the appropriate keys to enable ACPI mode, save and exit BIOS setup. And that may vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. Okay, so are we all clear so far on power states and how to make sure that that's activated in your BIOS settings? Okay, there's a worksheet on this as well, on the power states. It's all in your notes, so it's reasonably self-explanatory. It's just a case of learning them. There's no easy way to do that. There's no handy mnemonics or anything like that I can give you, unfortunately. Okay, Windows lets you alter power consumption in individual components or the entire system. You can mess around with the hard drive, display, the shutdown, hibernate, and suspend modes. And that's shutdown, hibernate, and sleep modes in Windows Vista and 7. You can also execute low battery warnings. Now, to adjust the power settings in the laptop, it's done through your control panel under power options. And you will get only the options available for your particular laptop and the devices that are there. Now, to configure the power settings, it's under Control Panel and Power Options in all Windows systems. Power Schemes and Power Plans are a collection of hardware and system settings that manage the power usage of the computer. The term in XP mode in XP is Power Schemes, and in Windows Vista and Windows 7 it is Power Plans. So you also need to be aware of that difference. These power settings can help you save energy, maximize system performance, or achieve a balance between the two. Both the hard drive and the display consume large amounts of power. They can be configured under the Power Schemes tab in Windows XP and the Change Plan settings in Windows Vista and 7. You can use the presets or customize them to your requirements. For example, if you want to change the sleep timer in Windows XP, you click Start, Control Panel, Power Options, and select the timer you want. In Windows Vista and 7, you click Start, Control Panel, Power Options, click the link Change when the computer sleeps. Select the timer you want. You can also change settings for the hard drive and screen because they're huge users of power. You can say get the laptop to turn off the HD after 3 minutes when operating on battery or after an hour when operating on AC power. So you have a certain amount of flexibility when you're messing around with these. You can also have the display turn off more frequently or change the brightness to save energy. Okay, if you don't want to completely shut down the laptop, you've got two options in Windows XP and three in the other.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
If you decide that you wanted to, say, for instance, have your screen off, that doesn't affect the way JAWS works, does it?
Not so far as I know. No, it doesn't, or it shouldn't do.
Okay, that's all I needed to know.
There are various ways that you can actually turn the screen off. In some laptops, you can do it by, fooling it into thinking that it's got an external monitor plugged in, and you can use the function keys for that. And some settings on that function key actually have an off setting as well as external and internal monitor. So there are all kinds of ways you can turn off your screen on a laptop. Okay, let's talk about the shutdown modes because they're also really important. Has anyone got any question before we talk about the shutdown modes in more detail? Okay, in XP we have two, and they're standby or suspend, sometimes it's called suspend, and hibernate. Standby, documents and applications again are saved in RAM, and that allows the computer to power on more quickly. So you can think of standby or sleep as saved to RAM. In hibernate mode, the documents and applications are saved to a temporary file on the hard drive, and that takes a little longer than standby to power on. Although hibernate is actually not recommended now. I remember us discussing this when I did this as a class. It can be a security risk because you've got a temporary file just sitting there with all your lovely settings in it, which is not a good thing to have available to viruses and other nasties. Okay. In your versions, because you've got more modern systems than I have, there are three. You have standby, which is called sleep in Windows Vista and 7. You have hybrid sleep and hibernate. So, sleep is the same as standby in XP. It's a save to RAM power mode. Hybrid sleep, documents and applications are saved in RAM and data is written to the hard disk, and that takes a little longer to power on, of course. And it's quite self-explanatory when you think about it, because the standby mode is saved to RAM and the hibernate mode is saved to disk. So the hybrid saves to both of them. And of course the hibernate mode in Windows 7 and Windows Vista saves data to the temporary file on the hard drive and of course takes the longest to power up. So, just in summary, there are two levels of shutdown in XP and three levels in Vista, and that's something you need to remember. You can also adjust the low battery warnings in your power plans and power schemes, and you can have a low battery alarm and a critical battery alarm. The low battery alarm, of course, warns you the battery is low, but with the critical alarm, you can initiate a forced standby, hibernate, or shutdown mode. All right, that's the end of 6.4.1. Are there any questions before we go on to how to replace components in a laptop?
I had some problems with my daughter's computer. And what used to happen was the disk drive kept on crashing, the hard disk drive, and one technician I took it to said that carrying the machine while it's in sleep mode can damage the hard drive, because according to him the hard drive still does turn occasionally while the computer's in sleep mode. Is that correct information?
Not according to what's here, but it could be. Elise, are you there? Can you clarify?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't get the question. What was that, Kate? Sorry, I've got a heap of problems with the business, so I'll talk to Kylie about it after. What was that?
Oh, I just asked whether it's true that you shouldn't carry a laptop while it's in sleep mode, because the hard drive actually does still occasionally move while the machine...
Mode. No, not really. No, because it'd be no different from carrying it while it's moving, which you can carry a laptop while it's moving. I've walked up and down the shop many a times talking to Kim. No, you should be right, because what happens is when it's in sleep mode, the hard drive is actually shut down. When you do that Chapter 6 worksheet, you'll actually learn about the six or seven different stages of the ACPI.
Yeah,
and when the computer's in sleep mode, it'll keep everything in memory or in RAM, and it keeps the RAM active but shuts down the display and the laptop and the processor. So the memory is happening. Now, there are other parts of ACPI where, for example, the process can be left running, but most of them, most of the settings that Windows uses does involve shutting the hard drive down. Now, when you shut the hard drive down, there are magnets inside the hard drive that bring the heads back to a normal stop position. So at all intents and purposes, the hard drive's inactive and it's no different from moving it around if the computer was fully powered down.
Have you, are you able to talk about the ECPI settings in Windows 7 just before we move
on?
I know you wanted to do that.
I do want to do that. Did you want me to do that now, did you?
Yeah, we're just about to move on from ECPI, so now's a good time.
All right, yep, no worries. It gives us a break from the traumas that's been going around here, I can tell you that. All right. Kim and I noticed, and Kim can comment on this too, with Windows 7, and I think Vista, is that right, Kim? Where what happens is the good old Microsoft and their infinite stupid type wisdom, they set the default action for the power button to actually put the computer into sleep mode. Note I said sleep mode, not hibernate, sleep. What that does
Vista
is...
Vista does that too.
Vista does it too, yeah. So you can see there's some mental cases there, whoever thought this up, because that's highly a stupid, dumb thing too. Now, obviously, that facilitates quick response whenever you open the lid of the computer or whenever you press the on button, the computer comes right up. What it doesn't take into account is that, of course, being vision impaired, jaws can drop out or gates, the computer can latch up or lock up. And we've seen it happen twice in the last month since Kim and I have had our new laptops, whereby the computer will latch up or put up a dialog box claiming that JAWS is failing, we're sorry for the problem, you know, stop the program or quit the program or whatever, wait for the program to respond, dialog box, etc., etc., which if JAWS is crashed, won't read. So, of course, you end up left with a computer that when you press the power button, because that's the first thing most blind people do if they can't get speech out of their computer, they go for the power button because you're really left with no choice. Rather than the computer shutting itself down in a normal ordered fashion, awaiting a subsequent power on and where it'll come up from scratch and, you know, you can log on and start all your programs, it will obviously go into sleep mode, and when it comes back up, it will resume in its crashed, gated up, latched up, locked up, horrible state. And you'll be left wondering why. That's why. So the first thing you have to do when you're degating after you install your Windows 7 or Vista machine is go and change the power options and make sure you tell the computer, tell the operating system to set your power button to power off the computer when it's pressed. Or you should be bringing your computer back up in a crashed state because it will go to sleep. Is that making sense?
It just explains exactly why I did what I did, change my power state as soon as I got the computer.
Well done, Kate. Yeah, because if you don't know that, now we knew to look out for this. In actual fact, mine got so bad, mine latched up so bad I couldn't actually get to the start button to shut it down, so I had no choice but to reef the battery off mine. Kim wasn't so bad, however, she did require me to look over the internet at the computer, and I had to guide her through with no speech to the shutdown menu. She was able to shut hers down in an ordered fashion when it happened. Actually, I think in her case, it happened with the NVDA. It was before we put JAWS in, so the whole computer had latched up, no speech, no nothing. It was shutting down, resuming, and coming up in its crash state. So that's something, a big fat gotcha to be aware of. Make sure the first thing you do when you install your Windows or get a new computer is check to see what the power is doing with the laptop, power button set to, and set it to off, because you need that massive, you know, that amount of control over the computer. The other thing I think Kim, Kylie wanted me to mention was the fact that in the newer PCs, they switch in different chips for the display when the display is running in battery mode. In the advent of JAWS 11 and JAWS 12 in the newer Windows 7 operating environment, both 32 and 64-bit, it installs a mirror driver. HAL and Zoom Text people do the same thing. There's a AI squared mirror driver installed in the device manager, and you'll see these in the device manager parallel to that of your normal display. That's to negate the highly complex video chain and video intercept that used to go on with JAWS in earlier versions of Windows. The gotcha is, that when the computer switches to the green chips, and the new Vostras are doing that, the Dell Vostras, most of the Dells are doing it, the Toshibas, and I think some HPs are doing it, it switches in a different set of chips, and as a result, JAWS will come up and claim that the video mirror driver hasn't been installed correctly. Please run JAWS with the repair option to fix this problem. Needless to say, running JAWS with the repair option does not switch this fix this problem. And from that point forward, you will have created and rendered useless your JAWS installation. The only way we knew out of it at the time was to do system restore, which fixes things up until the next time you unplug your computer. So here's what happened to us. I installed JAWS, got it going, and it was all fine until I took it out and put it on battery. And the moment I reefed out the power cord, I created my JAWS. Not being aware of it at the time until the next restart, incidentally. Won't be apparent right away. So again, in Windows 7, unfortunately, with the wonderful green chips and things that have been done with these newer devices to cause them to be more energy efficient on battery, you are going to need to go into your advanced power options and set, and this is before you put JAWS in, so that's another reason why I say put in the NVDA in first. Set it so that when it goes into battery mode, it stays in high performance. The display stays in high performance. So you really need it not to go into balanced or low performance mode, or you will force it to start different chips up and thereby cratering the mirror driver. And that is the only fix or workaround to the problem to this point. One would hope that in JAWS 12.1, when it comes out, or whatever the next version of JAWS happens to be, they may have addressed it.
Why on earth the mirror driver hasn't been manufactured to look for every video adapter is beyond me.
Yeah, the official word on that question is that it's possible that it can't see them. Our friend Will, who's a former cabbie student, and myself tend to disagree with that theory, because references to those other video adapters or video pieces of hardware would probably be scattered throughout the registry, so available for things like JAWS to look up.
Okay, well, just be aware of those things, folks, especially if you're planning on buying a new Windows 7 laptop. Go into your power options and change those settings first before you do anything
else. Before you put JAWS in.
Yep, install NVDA.
Sorry, Freedom, but until further notice, I will not go recommending that vision impaired people put your product in first. And that's that, and that's the reason why.
NVDA works really well.
So in other words, fix it, FS.
Yep, okay. Has anyone got any other questions on ACP standards and power settings before we move on to all the replaceable components and how to replace them? Okay, cool. Replaceable components. Some of the things that can be replaced on your laptop are the AC adapter, the battery, the optical drive, the hard drive, the memory, the PC expansion cards. Read the manual and follow all the safety precautions when doing any of these. Always disconnect the power and remove the battery before installing or removing laptop components that are not hot swappable. I don't know anyone who actually removes the battery as well, usually. Yeah, yes, disconnect the power, but yeah, I don't know. Anyway, the AC adapter. And that must be compatible with the manufacturer and model of laptop that you have. AC adapters are either auto-switching or fixed input. Auto-switching AC adapters can switch between 110 volts and 220, while a fixed input AC adapter only operates under a specific voltage. So, some of these you can use in different countries, and some you can only use in the one country, and you have to be aware of what your adapter is, because if you plug it into the wrong socket, you could have dire consequences. Okay. To replace a laptop
machine
battery,
won't work or you'll blow it up.
Yeah, one of the two, and neither of them are very desirable. Okay, how to replace the battery. And this used to be an exam question. I'm not quite sure it still is, but it was once, so it's pays to be aware of it. To remove the battery from the battery bay. 1. Move the battery lock to the unlock position. 2. Hold the release lever in the unlock position and remove the battery. And to install the battery into the battery bay. 1. Insert the battery. 2. Make sure that both battery levers are locked. Okay, you can also replace an optical drive, and to do this, which is figure yes.
I didn't think it was very sort of safe for us to go in there and play with the battery, or is it all right?
Yeah, it's perfectly safe. If you've got the laptop unplugged and you've got it upside down, you can certainly replace the battery on a laptop. You can buy batteries and just put them in. It's that we have a lot of these blindness-specific devices that are not battery replaceable, which is a pain in the bum. But for laptops, yes, you can go out and buy the proper battery for your machine and easily replace it.
It's very simple to do, and it's actually a lot less complicated than their instructions.
Okay, and also you can replace the optical drive in your laptop even though it's attached, and that's not particularly difficult either. You just remove all the... You press the button to open the drive and remove any media in the drive, of course. How silly, why wouldn't you? Close the tray. No, really? Okay, then you slide the latch to release the lever that secures the drive. Pull on the lever to expose the drive and remove the drive from the bay. And to install the DVD or CD drive, insert the drive securely and push the lever inwards. Hard drives are also easily replaceable. They're accessible from via a screw in the bottom of your laptop. And what you do is you remove the screw that holds the hard drive in place. You slide out the assembly, remove it, remove the hard drive faceplate from the hard drive itself, and that's your hard drive out of there, and you can do it, and you can replace it or do anything you wish to it. Okay, put it in a dock or do whatever. And now, to install a hard drive in a laptop, you attach the hard drive faceplate to the hard drive itself, slide the drive into the hard drive bay, and put the screw back in, and you are done. It's actually it's reasonably simple. Yeah, the only gotcha is you've got a tiny amount of space to work in, and that's the real, it's the hard part of working with laptops.
Can I make a comment?
Yep.
Okay, I did mine in the Triple E. I put a 500 gig hard drive in there about a month or so ago. Kyla remembers when I did it. Very easy to get the bits. Pull off a cover, slide out the plate, and in actual fact, undo two screws in this case. And then once the screws are undone, then you slide out the plate. Now, being a SATA hard drive means that the power and the data connector for the SATA have to be at a certain space apart. It's all part of the standard. So once you take the screws out, you're then free to slide the plate to one side or back forward, depending on which way you're looking at it. And it just pulls the SATA connector off the back of the... that's on the hard drive off the appropriate SATA connector on the computer. And then you lift the plate with its hard drive out, and then take the hard drive out of the plate like you might if it was a bigger affair. There was one I did back in Phoenix with Jackie last year that was a right bastard to get out. It was nothing but a bastard. We even looked it up on the net, and I just had to give it a good old heave-ho. It undid all the screws, like they told us how to do it, and it wasn't because of the hard drive being a pain in the neck. It was just because it was just an older machine. It was still a SATA drive, by the way, but it's just that the whole assembly just needed a decent shove. I thought I was going to break it. I really did. Her husband said, I'm rather glad you didn't. I'm rather glad I didn't either. I didn't want to own up to Carl. Anyway, again, that was more of an enclosure rather than a nice little plate arrangement as the Triple E was. So there was a sort of a, I had to slide that, undo the screws that held the hard drive in, slide it out, replace the hard drive, and then it all went in very nicely. But like I said, so they do differ. Some are easier than others.
Yeah, they do. And, but it's
and I didn't want to own up to Carl that I broke his wife's computer. So I'm glad I didn't.
No, not a good idea. Yeah, but they're all reasonably standard, and they've all got screws in the bottom that you have to undo. And that includes the memory, which is the next on the list. And what people, again, is the memory module that a laptop uses?
SATA.
Yay, yep, small outline DIMM, right. Okay, so you yank the screw out to expose the memory module, and you press outward on the clips that hold the sides of the SODIMM in place, just as you would on a desktop. Lift up to loosen the SODIMM from the slot and remove it. And to install a new one, you would align the notch at a 45 degree angle. That might be slightly tricky. Then gently press down until the clips lock. Replace the cover and install the screw. Now, in my netbook, the RAM access panel is actually underneath the battery panel. You take the battery out and the RAM panel is actually underneath there. So that's a little bit more difficult to get to than it otherwise would be. But then it's a reasonably easy matter of just taking one out of the slot and putting another one in when you're there. Okay, another thing that can be replaced is a PC expansion card also. All PC expansion cards, including Express cards, are inserted and removed using similar steps. To remove the PC expansion card, press the appropriate eject button to release it. And to extol the card, press the blue button inwards. I never used to press any buttons when I installed my cards, and they never had any problem. I just put it in and it would click. Just as simple as that. Now, on some laptops, the PC cards and optical drives and USB devices are hot swappable. Now, the internal hard drive, the RAM and battery are not hot swappable. And a hot swappable doesn't usually apply to the keyboard either. But, Elise.
What's up?
I was just saying the hot swappable does not apply. The term hot swappable does not usually apply to the keyboard, but
no, it doesn't. Just ask Will Taylor.
It would have if you hadn't pressed the wrong button.
Well, yeah, we had actually had the keyboard in, and since I accidentally hit the sleep button, but yeah, no. Other than that, we were talking to Kylie and Terry on Skype that night, and we decided to hot swap the keyboard. We shouldn't do it. It's not recommended. Please don't try it at home, sort of trick. It's a bit like watching Evel Knievel jump over all these buses. Don't do this at home. So don't. So if you're crazy like we are, then you do it on your own head, because that's not really considered a hot swappable device.
Okay.
But we'd like to tell that story because it's fun.
Yes, it was very funny. I really didn't know if it was going to work or not. But here we were sitting there talking, and one keyboard comes out and the other one goes in on the netbook. So there we are. It actually can be done, but nah, don't do it. Not unless you're really experienced. Now, to remove hot swappable devices, does anyone know what you should do? A lot of people just pull them out, I know, but you shouldn't do that. What should you do?
If you can find it, safely remove hardware.
Yep, safely remove hardware is in the system tray. So it says to left-click the icon in the Windows system tray to ensure the device is not in use, and then left click the device you want to remove, and a message will pop up to tell you that it is safe to remove the device. If you try and remove the device, just yank it out, you may corrupt it, because if it's still writing data, it's finished. You've ruined it, and you're not going to know that until you try and put it back in again. So although it takes a bit more time, always go to your system tray and use safely remove hardware. Okay, before we move on to communication hardware, are there any questions? Cool. Okay, you have a few more communication devices to deal with on a laptop than you do with a desktop, and there are extensive information in your notes on how to remove all of these things in Windows XP, Windows Vista and 7. So read through. We'll just go through this in a more sort of compact way, because we don't have huge amounts of time left. Okay, Ethernet, wireless, modem, Bluetooth and infrared and cellular one are all communication modes that you could be dealing with in a laptop. Right. Ethernet installation. Plug the cable into the NIC port, and you know which one it is. It is the what, people?
Oh, what about a RJ45?
Yay, RJ45. Yep, it is the good old one on steroids. Okay. Configure the IP address information. It goes into details on how to do that, but you don't actually need to know this for a couple more chapters, and we're going to talk about networking in Chapter 8, and you will learn all you thought you ever wanted to know initially about the TCP/IP properties. Under Network Connections in XP and TCP/IP v4 under Vista and Windows 7. But that is under Network Connections or the Network and Sharing Center, depending on which flavor of Windows you're using, in the Control Panel. And wireless network installation and configuration is the same as Ethernet, although wireless adapters can be attached by expansion ports. My sister hasn't got a wireless NIC in her laptop, so she uses a USB adapter, which actually gives her better connectivity than on my laptop, which has the NIC in it. Excuse me. There's a lot of information here about modem installation. You're not going to be using a modem a hell of a lot, but just read through the notes to say how it's done. It's kind of long and complicated. But what you will need to know about, again, is Bluetooth, because you're probably going to use that even more. Installation and configuration steps. That's in Figure 2. Windows will activate your Bluetooth connections by default, hopefully. If the connection is not active, you look for a switch on the front face or on the side of the laptop to enable the connection. Make sure Bluetooth is enabled in the BIOS before installing and configuring the device. Turn on the device and make it discoverable to Windows, and check the device's documentation to learn how to do that. You can use the Bluetooth wizard to search and discover any Bluetooth devices that are in discoverable mode. And there are ways you can do this in the various flavors of Windows, and it will tell you how to do that. Learn those steps, because again, it may be something that you're questioned on. You can use the Bluetooth devices tab to configure the Bluetooth settings once you've installed the device. Now, the device tab adds, removes a device, or reviews the properties of a device. The Options tab controls how devices discover and connect to your computer. So obviously, I guess, talking about a dialog box here with various tabs of information. The COM ports tab sets up new incoming and outgoing serial ports. Right, whoever uses serial ports now, anyway, that's what it does. The Hardware tab lists Bluetooth devices that are installed on your computer. Okay, any questions so far?
I was just gonna make a comment that I, you know, you say who uses serial. I think what happens when you use, for instance, the Braille note as a Braille display for JAWS, it calls it COM serial over Bluetooth.
Okay, so you'd want to look in the COM tab to make sure that that was all set correctly then. That's interesting to know. Yeah, I hadn't seen a serial port for a very long time, I must admit. Okay, infrared installation and configuration steps. And this is pretty simple, really, compared to some of the others, if you're still using infrared devices. Again, I found them just a pain in the bum and then really unreliable. But to do this, you make sure the infrared is enabled in the BIOS, like you would with any other communication device. Turn on the device to make it discoverable to boot Windows and align your devices so the infrared transceivers are within 1 meter of each other and the transceivers are pointing at each other. So the transceivers need to be pointing at each other for the thing to work, and even then you'll be lucky. When the devices are correctly aligned, an icon will appear on the taskbar with a pop-up message. Click the pop-up message to display the infrared dialog box. And you can access the infrared dialog box through your control panel. Or you can use, and if you really want to use a USB infrared and you don't have built-in, you can use a USB or serial adapter if you really are a fan of infrared. You can use the dialog box tabs to configure the infrared settings just as you can with Bluetooth. And the last communication setting we're going to talk about is Cellular One, and there's not much to say here actually. Because laptops with integrated Cellular One capabilities need no software installation and no additional antennae or accessories. When you turn the laptop on, the capabilities are ready to be used, hopefully. This is all theoretical, of course. You never know with Windows. But if the connection is not active, look for a switch on the front face or on the side of the laptop to enable the connection. And of course, you've got to make sure it's enabled in the BIOS, like everything else, before you install and configure any devices. You can then go ahead and install the manufacturer's broadband card utility software and use the utility software to manage the network connection. And you can the software has an icon that sits in the taskbar or in the start and in the programs menu. We're going to keep talking about cell phones and cellular standards for a while, but has anyone got any questions before we move on to section 6.5? Okay, just again, read your notes because they have extensive ones on the differences between Windows XP, Vista and 7 on actually how to do all of those things, and you may be asked about it. So read those all through. It's fairly self-explanatory, and yell if you have any questions. Right, mobile phone standards. And most of us have one of those. It seems, I don't know about you, but I can't imagine life without one now. You know, if I want to go out by myself and run around the place, I wouldn't be without my phone these days. And some people, if they have an iPhone, for instance, which can do Skype and all the other things that they want to do, would never be without it because they're permanently connected wherever they are, which is kind of cool. I have a friend in Sweden, for instance, who only uses his iPhone for Skype or maybe his iPad, but he's always out and about, and I never know where he is when he's calling me half the time. Anyway, when people began to use cell phones, there were few industry-wide standards applying to cell phone technology. Without standards, you couldn't really make calls to people that were on other networks, and it was just too difficult and expensive. But today, there are industry standards used, and of course that makes it easier to use cell phones to make calls. When the industry started, of course, most cell phones were analog, but today they are mostly digital. But unfortunately, the different standards have not been universally adopted, so you'll find that some standards apply to one part of the world and some apply to another. And you can get cell phones some cell phones have multiple standard capability and others don't. So you need to be aware of how you're going to use your cell phone if you're buying one or if you're choosing one for a customer, because if the customer travels overseas, they're going to need a multiple standard phone. Otherwise, it just causes too many problems and you can't be in communication. Okay, the first generation, 1G, of cell phones began service in the 1980s. 1G primarily used analog standards, including Advanced Mobile Phone System, AMPS, and Nordic Mobile Telephone, NMT. I think in my part of the world, we used NMT from memory. In an analog system, the voice information is sent by varying radio signals used by the phone in the same pattern as the speaker's voice. Unfortunately, this means that interference...
Yeah, so much for the old Bearcat scanner.
Yes, and of course interference and noise was a problem.
Tell me, I've had to misspent youth.
So that's why digital was born, because it just got too difficult in terms of interference quality. However, there are some downsides to the digital signals, because digital signals convert voices into a series of ones and zeros, good old binary, but you get a degraded signal, a degraded quality, because the ones and zeros can never be a faithful representation of your voice. Human voices are just too complex and individual for that. However, the advantage with digital signals is that they're robust. They can be fixed using error correction routines if there's interference. And also, they can be compressed, so that makes the system much more efficient than analog. In the 90s, the second generation, 2G, of cell phones was marked by a switch from analog to digital standards. So 1G was analog, 2G it changed to digital. That's the thing you need to remember about those. That's pretty much the only thing you need to remember at this point. Some of the 2G systems are Global System for Mobile, GSM, which operates in some parts of America and operated here for a while under Vodafone, I think. Terry, was that correct? Vodafone?
Vodafone had GSM. Haven't you still got GSM in NZ?
I would think so.
No, probably not now. Vodafone has changed to 3G mostly.
Yeah, but I thought it was only the data that went on the 3G, not the actual voice. As anyone that say data, you know, people using it as an internet service.
Some areas don't have 3G coverage, so they'd have to use GSM for some of it, surely.
Yeah, they would.
Because the only
I think that's gradually dying out.
CDMA is what Telecom uses.
And of course, where you are, John, which standard is used in your part of the world? Because I know in the States that some parts use GSM and some parts use CDMA.
I don't own a cell phone, and I have no clue.
Ah, okay. Well, that was always a bit of a problem in the States, but GSM was really common in Europe. That was the other place it was very common. There was also something
It's
called
really because of
integrated.
Ericsson.
Yeah. There was also a standard called Integrated Digital Enhanced Network, or IDEN, and of course, Code Division Multiple Access CDMA. Now, 3G standards let cell phones go beyond simple voice and data communications. You can send and receive text, photos, and videos, and you can also access the internet and use the global positioning system. I've never used GPS, but I know a lot of people who do use it on their cell phones, blind people. Now, as the 3G standards were being developed, there were extensions to the existing 2G standards, and these transitional standards are known as 2.5G. So 3G, 1G was analog, 2G it changed to digital, and 3G was the advent of email, photos, text, and all that stuff. And that's also something that sometimes pops up in exam questions, so just be aware of that. Fourth generation standards have been championed by many users in response to the availability of increased data rates. And higher data rates, of course, let you download files such as video and music faster than was available with standards of previous generations. There are five tabs in the figure one to view more information about the cell phone standards. And there are new technologies that add multimedia and network capability, can be bundled with cell phone standards as well. There are some terms that are associated with these services, and a lot of providers actually will charge for all these add-ons, as you know, if you own a cell phone. Look at the diagrams in the section for more information, but some of the terms are short message service, SMS, and that is used for sending text messaging. MMS, what's that, folks? If short message service is for text, what's MMS for?
Multimedia message.
It sure is. So if I want to send a picture of my cat to my sister, I use the multimedia service,
You'd
which
be
would be
better off
so helpful
just to
on my
show
phone.
it to her over the other side of the table.
Yeah, take a look at the terminology there anyway, and the diagrams for that section, at the end, the diagrams at the end of section 6.5. So basically, with the cell phones, really you need to know that G1 is analog, G2 is digital, G3 was the advent of photographs and text and email and all that, and G4 is the up-and-coming standard which will allow a lot more movement of data. But that's all it really says. So those are the kind of things you need to know with cell phone standards. Okay, we've got 20 minutes to go, and that should be time enough to cover the last two sections of preventive maintenance and troubleshooting. What fun! Of course, laptops are mobile and have integrated parts, so that environments a desktop machine might handle would be deadly to a laptop. If you're in a laptops can move into all kinds of places. If you're on a building site or somewhere that's kind of wet and damp and horrible, there are people who take their extreme laptops exploring with them up mountains and all kinds of places these days, and PDAs and phones and the like. So they have to be able to cope with all those conditions. Of course, if you spill something on your keyboard of a laptop, you're in trouble. So what we're going to talk about in this section is cleaning procedures and optimal operating environment. Anyone got any questions before we go any further? Okay, folks, test alert. Proper routine cleaning is the easiest, least expensive way to protect and extend the life of a laptop. So if they ask you what is the best way to do that, it's proper routine cleaning. You need to use the right tools and read the fine manual again. Okay, to clean the keyboard, turn off the laptop. Disconnect all of the attached devices. Disconnect the laptop from the electrical outlet. Remove all the installed batteries and wipe the laptop and the keyboard with a soft lint-free cloth that is lightly moistened with water or computer screen cleaner. Does anyone actually remove the batteries when they do all this? You should unplug it and everything, but I've never heard of anyone removing the batteries. Does anyone do that?
No, I didn't think so.
I never cleaned my computer or my keyboard at all. I just haven't. It never occurred to me to do it.
Ah, you see? It's actually, I think, quite a lot easier than trying to figure out with a poor old desktop. Yeah, I was a bit like that, Kim, I'm afraid, before I came into Cavi. Okay. To clean the ventilation, it's of course got to turn off the laptop and disconnect all attached devices. Disconnect the laptop from the power, of course, we all know that. It says remove all the installed batteries again. And you can clean, how do you think the vents might be cleaned on a laptop?
I took mine down to the computer man and he sucked them out with a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, an anti-static one or a compressed air is the other way that you do it. And it's not difficult to do that for yourself once you've learned how. And you can remove any difficult debris with tweezers. John, you were going to say?
I was just going to say what you just said.
Okay, now the LCD cleaning procedures are the same as in a desktop and a laptop. Who remembers what those are?
Wipe with a lint-free cloth and a tiny bit of moisture or a special screen cleaning fluid.
Yep, with an LCD it's got to be a specialist fluid, and they say here there's one thing, it's a cautionary note. What should you do with the fluid? Put it on what and not what?
Put it on the cloth, not on the screen.
Yeah, and that may seem obvious to some, but for some people I guess it's not. So yeah, always put your cleaner on the cloth and not the screen. Again, it's going on about removing installed batteries. Now the touchpad cleaning procedures are fairly similar. Most laptops these days have got a touchpad on them, or a mouse or a mouse tracking pad at least. And again, you follow the procedures for disconnecting everything from the laptop. And you wipe the surface of the touchpad with a soft lint-free cloth that is moistened with an approved cleaner. Never use a wet cloth on a touchpad. Always use an approved cleaner. Don't use water. Okay, now the small screen of a PDA or a smartphone requires special care. The user operates these devices by touching the screen with a stylus. If the dirt is... If there's dirt there, the PDA might not accurately detect the stylus position or movement. And the dirt can also scratch the screen. Clean the screen with a small amount of non-abrasive cleaning solution on a soft cloth. To protect the screen surface from a stylus, use self-adhesive screen covers. Okay, and the same cautions as above. Don't put the cleaner on the screen, put it on the cloth, and use only one that's approved for that purpose. Now, the next is disk drives, and we're talking about external ones here, which is optical drives and floppies, and they both use a commercial cleaning kit. Now, Kate, you mentioned this way back in Chapter 1, and I said that we would actually get to talk about this. So do you want to go through what you do?
Sorry, Carly?
Kate.
Do you mean the one that I was saying I used for my CD player?
That's right, yeah, because it's the same with a floppy disk drive. It has a user commercial kit. So just run through here what we do here. It's very easy.
Yeah, it was easy, actually. I opened the drawer, put this little disk in that's got all sorts of little brushes and funny things on it, put the drawer in, pressed the play button, and... the lady gave you all these instructions about you'd wait for it to do this and then press the forward key and then press this key after the beep and then press another key after the beep, and then she said, I'm finished, and it was as easy as that.
I know, isn't it just? It's great. And if you feel the bottom of an optical cleaning disc, you'll find these little brushes there. Because the lens that reads the laser in your optical drive often needs cleaning. It can get dusty and dirty and horrible and result in data errors on your CD discs. So keep those clean. And do the same with a floppy drive if you've got one. Get a commercial disc, stick it in, and follow the instructions as to how long you should let it spin for. It's really, really easy. Now, cleaning the discs, CD discs themselves, yes?
I have a question about the optical drives. In the past, I've used compressed air just as I'm cleaning around, and I've not seen that as a recommendation. Should that not be done?
Not in an optical drive itself. You need to clean an optical drive with it with a recommended cleaner, which is an optical disc. It looks like a CD, but it's got little brushes on the bottom, and you stick it in there and follow the instructions, and it will clean the lens and the heads.
Okay.
Okay, how to clean a CD? We all have CDs that skip and cause errors and stop playing and do all sorts of horrible things, and it's a pain in the bum, I know. Now, it says here, if the discs are really deeply scratched, you just need to replace them. There's no point in trying to deal with a disc that is too badly scratched. They can create data errors, so throw those away. Make them coasters or something. You can use, there's lots of commercial products out there that you can use for cleaning a CD. You hold the disc by the outer edge or by the inside edge. Don't be holding the disc by its surface. Gently wipe the disc with a lint-free cotton cloth. Never use paper or any material that can scratch the disc or leave streaks. That includes tissue paper, just don't bother with it. Wipe from the center of the disc outward. Never use a circular motion. Apply a commercial CD or DVD cleaning solution to the lint-free cotton cloth if you want to, and wipe again if there are any contaminants remain on the disc. Let the disc dry before you put it back into the drive. Okay, before we go on to optimal operating environment, have we got any questions about cleaning of laptop components? Okay, that's cool. Well, it's all very straightforward. It's not dissimilar to what we learned in Chapter 2 about cleaning desktop components. There's not a huge amount of difference there. Okay, optimal operating environments is really important for laptops. Of course, a laptop needs to be clean of and free of potential contaminants and within the temperature and humidity range specified by the manufacturer. Clean the laptop frequently, don't obstruct the vents. Now that's important. Laptops are called laptops, but often if you put a laptop on your lap, it can be angled in such a way that the vents will be obstructed. And if that happens, your laptop will overheat. So it really is best to have the laptop on a hard surface if you can manage it. Like a tray. If you have it on your knee, put it on a tray or something. My sister often operates hers. She gets her, she's got a special tray she keeps it on, which is portable. She just sticks it on knee, does what she needs to do, and then puts it away when she's finished. Keep the room temperature between 45 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 7 and 32 degrees C. Keep the humidity level between 10 to 80%. Nothing much you can do about that, really, but you need to, unless you've got an extreme machine, check your recommended settings. Pack your laptop in an approved bag or a carton for transport and research the recommended values, especially if you plan to use it in extreme environments. And if you're really active, you may want to do that. So just be aware that there are optimal operating temperatures and humidity for a laptop, but read the manufacturer's instructions. And that, folks, is the end of preventive maintenance. Before we go on to troubleshooting, have we got any questions or comments? Okay, there's 10 minutes to go. We should be able to race through this reasonably well.
You're wanting to do this, the quiz?
No, we're on to troubleshooting. We probably won't have time for the quiz.
Good, right. Okay, keep going.
Okay. Right. Okay, when troubleshooting problems with laptops or portable devices, you need to find out if a repair is cost effective. Now, this is different than desktops because in desktops, of course, the components are fairly standard, so you can just go out and buy a new one when the old one dies. To determine the best course of action, compare the cost of the repair with the replacement cost of the laptop or portable device, less the salvage value. Now, because many portable devices change rapidly in design and functionality, and in this case they're talking about smartphones and PDAs and not laptops, they're often more expensive to repair than to replace. And those of us who have cell phones, I guess, will replace them after a certain amount of time. When I had a job, it used to be a regular 2-year thing. Of course, now that I'm not in the paid workforce, I haven't replaced it for more than 4 or 5 years. As it still goes, I'm still keeping hold of it. But usually you find those things are better to replace than to repair. Laptops, on the other hand, can be replaced or repaired. So, and you need to identify how expensive that's going to be and whether it's worth doing what. Right. Excuse me. Just one. Okay, we all know the steps of the troubleshooting process. We're going to follow them along as we go, so I'm not going to make you recite them to me again. Okay, 6.7.1, review the troubleshooting process. Computer problems can result from a combination of hardware, software, and network issues. And with laptops, you've also got possible wireless issues to deal with. And we'll learn more about wireless in Chapter 8. Okay, some questions, some open-ended questions related to laptops. What could you ask your customer?
What were you doing when the problem occurred?
Yeah, good question. Anyone else?
What errors did you get?
Yeah, good one. Good old event viewer, you need to consult that. Okay, you're familiar with closed and open questions. Okay, one of the closed questions you might need to ask is the laptop under warranty? Now, that's an important question because if it is, you don't want to touch it because often you need to be manufacturer certified to work on a laptop if you're a tech. So if the laptop's under warranty and you fiddle with it, you may void that warranty. So if the thing's under warranty, get them to take it to their local service centre. Of course, there are things around battery that you need to be aware of when you are troubleshooting a laptop. Can the laptop use its battery? Does the battery hold its charge? All that kind of thing. Now, some common causes of battery problems could be, the laptop problems could be what? There's a couple of battery ones here. What I've just mentioned them.
With a battery, it's important to notice whether the battery is charging when it's plugged in, because if the battery's not charging, then you unplug it from the power, and of course that's going to cause some sort of a problem.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes the batteries don't hold their charge, so you need to do that. And that may be also due to a loose cable connection. Okay, the keyboard doesn't work. What could be happening there, do you think?
Maybe there's a loose connection in the keyboard.
Did they mention food or liquids?
Yeah, your keyboard could be dirty. That isn't actually mentioned here, but it's a good one. Yes, that earlier I mentioned in passing. Yep.
They're leaving out really obvious things like, is your power, like if your laptop's plugged in, is the switch turned on at the wall? Stuff like that.
Oh, I guess so, yeah. It's easy to forget that the switch is not... yeah, sometimes my sister does that when she plugs hers in.
Well, it's just such an obvious thing and really simple, and sometimes it's, yeah, you go all these complicated problem-solving things and it's a real basic answer.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they go into things like, you know, you can have loose RAM and all kinds of stuff here. But yes, you're right. There's some of those obvious issues I've actually missed. So it's always helpful to be aware of those. Now, when we're implementing a solution, we've gone through identifying the problem and determine a theory of probable causes and determine exact cause. Okay. To implement the solution, there are all these research options, and they're no different from the ordinary ones. Everything from other technicians to news groups and manufacturer FAQs and the like. And there will be, I think it's in Chapter 10, a worksheet that asks you to research all those different types of sources. Okay. Now, once you fix the problem, you can reboot the laptop, attach all the peripherals, test the laptop only on battery, print a document from an application, type a sample document to test the keyboard, check the event viewer for warnings or errors. Then, of course, you need to tell the customer all about what you've done and have the customer verify that everything's okay now, and give the customer all relevant paperwork, as well as make sure that all of your logs and journals and work orders are up to date, including all the components you used in the repair and the time you spent to resolve the problem. Okay.
And the bill.
Yeah, and the bill, which is not in there, but it's sort of important, really. If you're doing this as a professional, you want to be paid. Okay, let's look at some of the laptop problems I've got here. The laptop doesn't power on. What are some probable causes? Terry mentioned one of them.
Yeah, it's not plugged in or switched on, or the battery's gone flat.
Yeah, it says battery doesn't plugged. Yes.
Or you're using, you've got a one that's set to 240 volts and you're trying to plug it in with one that's 210, you know, 110 or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that could be it as well. That's another thing they don't mention. Okay.
A lot of the power supplies you get with modern laptops are capable of running on both 240 and 110, as I proved when I went overseas recently.
Yes, we did mention a little bit about auto-switching, but yeah, that's something that could happen if you're not using an auto-switching
perhaps
power
an older
supply.
One might have difficulty, but I'm thinking they're all switch modes now, and they'll work wherever you plug them in.
Okay, the battery doesn't hold a charge. What are you going to do? That's the next problem. Sorry, Kate.
I'd replace the battery if it doesn't hold the charge.
Yeah, easy enough.
Would it depend on what kind of battery it is before you throw it away? I mean, some of the charge sequence for the older ones could be checked into.
That's a good point, John. It actually does say here that the proper charging and discharging practices may not have been followed. If you're using anything older than a lithium ion, that may be the case. There's a couple of other things it mentions here. What could they be? What else could affect your battery
usage? Still
may
be cheaper to throw it away and get a new one than to pay you.
Yeah, possibly, but of course you wouldn't need to do that because you could do it yourself. That's the whole point of being in this class. Okay, it could be that you've got extra peripherals draining the battery, or we mentioned ACPI earlier, what could you do to make sure your battery lasts a bit longer in ACPI? What could you do?
You could change your power plan so that there's not... You could change your power plan so that it's... You could maybe reduce the brightness of your screen and maybe reduce... Or, for instance, I use an external keyboard, so maybe go back to using just the laptop's keyboard instead.
How about also the mode for your hard drive to power down?
Sorry, John, you're breaking up there.
Reduce the time that your hard drive is spinning.
Yep, all those are really good solutions. Okay, let's move on to a display problem. And this is something that sometimes comes up in exams as well. So this problem is the external display has power but no image on the screen. What might be some probable causes of this?
Is that the one that is in the laptop, or is this an external peripheral device? If it's an external peripheral device,
we're talking about
monitor,
the one in the laptop here.
Okay.
It could be either, actually. I mean, you could have a faulty cable.
Yeah, but somebody else might have played with the power settings and had changed the monitor so that it doesn't come on.
What about the brightness and contrast and all that?
You could do that, although it really is, the display is dark, completely dark, so it's not showing anything. If it's an external display, it could be that there's no video signal being sent. Now, you could reconnect or replace the video cable, or you could use the FN key along with the multipurpose key to toggle the external display. Often when people plug in internal displays, they forget to the external displays, they forget to toggle the button. So when you're connecting an external monitor to a laptop, you plug it in and use the FN key with the appropriate function key, and you know which one it is because there's a little image of a monitor on it, to tell the laptop that it's using an external display. Okay, there are other things here to do with display, but we're actually run out of time. So what we really discussed here is the differences in the... and the comparisons between laptops and desktops. And you know there are some differences because desktops work on form factors and laptops are mainly proprietary. But there's a lot of information that we haven't covered here in your notes, mostly because it's not actually essential, but there are procedures that you might want to read, the differences between XP, Vista and Windows 7, for instance, for connecting devices. And there's some worksheets to do, but they have... returned to what I would say would be a more sane level of volume. And in terms of worksheets, it's good to see the work rolling in. Please keep it coming. I'm really pleased with the standard of work that I'm seeing at the moment. There aren't actually any worksheets for Chapter 7, so bear that in mind. It means you've got a bit of an extra week to get caught up before we do Chapter 8. Now again, chapter 8 hasn't got a huge amount of work attached to it in terms of worksheets, but it is another big chapter. It'll be a two-weeker again. So just bear that in mind. Before we go, has anyone got any questions or comments or other things?
Oh yeah, Kylie, you talked to me the other day about the Windows 7 labs now being available. I haven't gone to get the PDF versions, but have you discovered whether there's some doc versions of those available?
Not yet. I'm still trying to find them, but when I do, I'll let you know. For those of you who get their Cisco emails, and I hope that you all do, it's kind of important. Cisco has announcements to make every so often that we all need to know about. The Windows 7 labs have arrived, but don't worry, you don't have to do them unless... And this is the one thing I didn't say to you, Kate. Unless you want to qualify for the A+. Now, you need to sit the Windows 7 exam if you want to prepare for A+. But I would recommend that if you really want to prepare for the CompTIA A+ exam, then the Windows 7 labs could be a good idea anyway. Because you've all got Windows 7 machines, you might want to fiddle around with them anyhow and just see whether they make more sense than the Vista. You've all done incredibly well using the Vista Labs to do the Windows 7 work, so you all need to be congratulated for that. It wasn't easy, especially because you have a tutor who isn't really familiar with either one of those operating systems. So get the Windows 7 PDFs down from the Cisco site. They are in the home page of our class, so you'll log on with your credentials, click on our class and you'll find them down the bottom of the page. If I find them in Word form, I'll let you know. Any more queries?
I was looking at lab 5.6 point something or other that was talking about using the command line for backing up the registry. And I can't find the command for Windows 7, so I haven't done that lab yet. I'll just have to go and research what that command is before I can give you the lab.
That's fine. There may be a lab pertaining to that in the Windows 7 new lab material, so if you want to get that down and do it, then feel free to do that. I find that mostly that Cisco's PDFs are pretty good compared to some. They're not usually bad at all in terms of, they can even be changed into text if you need to. So it's not a biggie. You'll find the student versions on your student homepage. So I'd recommend that you all go and grab those. Any other comments or queries? Complaints? Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for coming, everybody. It's been great yet again. You're a fantastic lot and I'm very lucky. I shall talk to you all through the week and we'll get this lecture up as soon as we can, and exams will be activated once again for those who want to sit them. But thanks for coming, folks. It's been great.
Thanks, Kylie.
Thanks, Kylie.